The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon.
In 1987, the late researcher, hypnotist, and author Bud Hopkins wrote the provocative international bestseller, Intruders, The Incredible Visitation at Copley Woods. The book chronicled the true story of Kathy Davis, a pseudonym for the real-life Deborah Jordan Cobble, and her startling alien abduction experiences. In 1992, Hopkins' book was made into a CBS miniseries of the same name. In 1994, Deborah co-authored with her sister Kathy Mitchell, Abducted, The Story of Intruders Continues. In August of 2021, Deborah's second book, Extraordinary Contact, Life Beyond Intruders, was published. She is a former Indiana MUFON investigator, co-founded her own paranormal group, Paranormal Underground, and along with co-founder Greg Cable, hosted the Midwest Paratalk podcast. And I'm honored to have her with us on the show today. So, Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. Thank you for asking me to come. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's our privilege and my honor. So, where exactly is Copley Woods?
It is in Indianapolis, Indiana. It's kind of south and east of the city, but it's in Indianapolis.
Okay. So let's start from the beginning. How old do you think you were when these anomalous events began?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of memory that goes back much further than six or seven. So, but there is definitely there was an event that happened when I was six, I think, and I had actually traveled up to Detroit, Michigan, with my older sister to visit with friends for an overnight visit. And while there, I suddenly became missing. I disappeared out of the backyard. And I do recall playing in the backyard with my friend and one of us kicking the little ball we were playing over the fence. And I jumped over the fence to go get the ball. And when I turned around to come back and jump back into the yard is when I realized I was suddenly felt lost. And I thought I wasn't at the right place. Now, mind you, I was, you know, somewhere I'd never been before anyway. And I was a little kid, but something didn't feel right. And I remember walking around the front of the house and thinking, okay, well, this looks like the house. I thought to myself, this kind of looks like the house where I'm supposed to be. And the door was open. So I went in the door. And I thought I recognized some stuff in the house, but it seemed a bit jumbled, not quite right.
Okay.
And as I turned around, I felt uncomfortable. And as I turned to leave out of this open door, there was a little boy standing between me and the door, about the same height as I was at the time. And I remembered that he had blonde hair and brown eyes, and he wanted me to stay. He asked me if I would stay and play with him. And he seemed lonely. And when he mentioned that he had some really nice, some cool toys, I kind of went with it, you know? And I remember following him into a room and then thinking, this room doesn't, in retrospect, I can tell you that when I walked into this room didn't fit the house at all. The room seemed much bigger than the whole house to me. It seemed huge, and there wasn't any furniture in it. It was really lit up, but yet I didn't see any lights or lamps or anything. And there were some, there was like a lowered, I don't, can't remember the word, where the, like a sunken floor in the center of it. And I sat on the edge of it. It was like a swimming pool without water. And I sat on what would be like the steps. And there, because there were things in the bottom that he said were toys, and he was handing them to me, and I was holding them. And then something poked me in the leg, and it hurt. And I remembered when it hurt, I got scared. And that's when I picked myself up and took off for the door. And when I got back into the living room area, where the house looked more like a house again, and he was asking me not to leave, a person who I thought was his mother came out from another room behind us, and she was mad. I remember her being angry and saying something like, what is she doing here? She doesn't belong here. And bam, as soon as she said that, it was like someone shoved me out the door, but yet I don't recall anybody touching me. But I just kind of shot out the doorway and stumbled on the walk path at the front porch. And when I looked up, there standing on the sidewalk where the path ended was my sister. And then I just remember feeling complete relief that there was my sister. So everything was going to be okay. You know, I'm in my kid head, just feeling relieved that I saw my sister. I remember running down to her, taking her hand. I don't recall her saying anything to me, nothing. I don't recall any conversation between us at all. We just went back to the house and we went home. I know while I was gone all day long, and actually the police were called even to look for me. And it was my sister who went out and brought me back. And as far as the distance between where she found me and where the house was that I was supposed to be at, it couldn't have been very far because we walked back to where I was supposed to be. So, and then I went home. I remember we went home and we never talked about it again.
You want to say you went home?
We went back to Indianapolis. Yes. Okay. When we went back to the house, you know, packed up our stuff and then drove back home to Indianapolis. Okay. And was never talked about it again. And I didn't even think about it for years. And it wasn't even brought up again until after the June 30th, 1983 incident, when Bud came to came to Indiana. I might have been the first time he came to Indiana to start his investigation. And he was basically kind of interviewing the family members. And he asked, we were all sitting around the kitchen table, and he asked my mom, do you remember other things from when, you know, she was younger? And my mom immediately said, there's that time she was missing in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, it was one of those things where it was so far away, and I had just like put it away somewhere and didn't even think about it. And didn't think to say anything to Bud. And then my mom brings it up. I'm like, oh my God, now I remember. I hadn't thought about that in years. And my sister confirmed it. And they told him the story about it. I told him what I remembered. And he was even able, my older sister was able to contact the people who owned the house where we went all those years later. And Bud was actually even able to speak to the woman who also confirmed what I had told them and what my parents had told him, what my mom and sister told him.
The woman in Detroit?
Yes, the woman who owned a house, the woman whose kids that we went to visit. Yeah.
So tell me, how did Bud Hopkins get involved in this? There's a big span of time there.
Huh? I know.
Get into the scene.
Well, it was June 30th, 1983. I had a couple months prior to that date, I had picked a bunch of books up at the library. And one of the books that I had picked up was called Missing Time. And to be frank with you, one of the reasons I picked it up to begin with is because it was a bright orange book with big black letters on it, and it got my attention. Started looking through it, and I thought, ooh, this is interesting. And I only was like, I really wasn't very familiar with the whole abduction thing, but I had heard of Barney and Betty Hill, mm-hmm. But this was in the 80s, and it really wasn't something I was into, I knew I was aware of some of it, but anyway, I thought, oh, this might be interesting. So I took it home and I tried to read it. And every time I tried to read a chapter, I'd have a panic attack. It just, something would trigger me, really bad. And I'd like have a panic attack. So I finally had to take the book back to the library, but I had noticed in the back of the book, there was a single page that said, if you think you've had an experience like this, you can write to the author. Here's the address.
Right.
And I remembered that. So then June 30, 83 comes along a few months later. And that whole weird night happened when I was a single mom living with my parents, and I had two little kids, and I was cutting out patterns for a seamstress that lived behind us, who was also my friend. So I was getting ready to go to her house and cut out some patterns for her, make a little extra money, help my folks out, mm-hmm. And I was standing at the kitchen window washing my hands after supper, getting ready to leave. And I noticed this weird light in the pump house of the swimming pool. So, I noted it. I mentioned it to Mom, and she didn't seem concerned about it. Something about it didn't rub me the right way. Well, I don't know whether the color was off or the fact that I'd been out there earlier and knew I had shut the door and had turned the light off, but she didn't seem concerned. So I went ahead and got in the car. But as I was getting ready to leave, I decided at the last minute, the house is a split is a tri-level, and it had a split driveway. One went down the front of the house, one went along the side. And then my dad had a workshop out back with Indian motorcycles and Sunbeam Alpine race cars, and things that he restored, a lot of money stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was concerned that somebody might be out there snooping around that. So I decided to go ahead and go down the side drive, hit the turnaround, and then come back facing the back of the house on the way out just to double check and make sure there wasn't anybody there that shouldn't be. Not at any time was I thinking aliens by any stretch of the imagination. Mm. But I didn't see anything amiss other than the back door to the pedestrian door to the garage that was attached to the house was open, which I thought odd. But I didn't stop. Instead, I made that 1.5 minute trip to Deanna's house. And I called my mom as soon as I got there. And I said, hey, I think the pedestrian door to the garage is open, but I didn't see anybody out there, and she says, don't worry about it. Your dad will be home soon. He'll take care of it. I'm like, okay, sure. Mm-hmm. So I hang up, and then she calls right back immediately to where I picked the phone up on instinct at my friend's house. And it's my mother. And she says, I need you to come home right now. And I kind of freaked out a little bit because my mom this was very much out of character for her. Mm-hmm. And my friend's husband heard me. I think he heard the alarm in my voice, and he yells over my shoulder, tell her to call the sheriff. That's what we pay him for. And she heard him, and she said, no, I don't want anyone here but you. And I'm like, okay. So I told my friend, I'll be back, in a few minutes. I'm just going to go see what's up. And I went home and pulled up that same side driveway and met my mom at the Florida room door. And I went in and I grabbed a shotgun that my dad kept by the trash compactor. And my mom says, that's not loaded right. And I'm like, I'm thinking, of course I do. I'm the one who asked you not to load it while we live there with my kids. I said, but whoever's out there doesn't know that I might be able to get close enough to them to hit them with it before they figure it out, And even that was out of character for me because I would do that now. But back then I was not nearly as brave. No, not at all. So, but I went out, looked around the pool, looked around the pump house, didn't see anything. I did notice that my dog, who had been in the garage, was under Dad's ladder truck, but she wouldn't come out. So I went into the garage, figuring if there's anybody out here, this is where they'd be hiding. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was no one there. But as I was finishing up my search in the garage, I suddenly felt like I was on fire. It just, this weird burning sensation swept over me, and it was so intense. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I got to get out of here right now. And I ran towards the pedestrian door. And when I hit that open doorway, something hit me in the chest, like right, I guess chest, where, solar plexus area. Mm-hmm. It was like this ball of light, and it was so intense. And I know my eyes were closed, but I could still see it like burning through my eyelids. And I felt my whole body shake. And it, the shaking became so intense. It was like a vibration, like vibrating each of my molecules, you know. And I have no idea how long I was in that condition, because I just, at that moment, I had no sense of time. And I just thought to my, I remember thinking, oh my God, I'm dead. That's the only thing I remember thinking. Mm-hmm. And soon, I say soon because I don't think I could have survived too long, but soon the vibrating and shaking stopped, and the light, the intensity got much less, but at that point, my vision was wrecked and I couldn't move. I still couldn't move. And I felt something pull down on my right shoulder from behind me, and I felt this really intense burning sensation in my right ear. And I heard somebody say it was unfortunate that I had felt pain. I don't know who said it. I couldn't see, I didn't see anybody. So I don't know who said that. Mm. And then the next thing I know, and I don't have any idea how I got from in the doorway to about 10 feet out on the cement patio in front of the doorway, but I'm out now. I'm out there on the cement patio, mm-hmm. and I see this movement in front of me, and I think, what, why are these kids in my mom, dad's backyard? You know, I thought there were kids in the backyard. They were all over the place, and they all just kind of lined up off to my right over by the driveway, and then just kind of glided down in front of me.
How many?
Six.
Six of
them. I believe there were six. Uh-huh. They didn't walk. They just kind of glided like real smooth. And mm-hmm. I could follow them with my eyes, but I couldn't see a lot of detail because at this point my vision had big splotches in it. Like when you get your, remember the old flash cubes and you got your picture taken, man, if you just didn't blink the right time, you were blown out. Right. That's the way my eyes were. My vision was like blown out. But I could see they were small, and that's why I thought they were kids, but I couldn't see a lot of detail, and they just kind of glided in front of me. And as I saw them go in front of me, I noticed a ball of white light, maybe the size of a basketball, that was much easier to look at than that intense light. Mm-hmm. And it might have been maybe 25 feet out in front of me, about as high up off the ground as I am tall. I'm 5'2". Mm-hmm. And that's when I saw the thing. I don't recall seeing the little kids go into this thing, but somehow they disappeared as I noticed this white light. And this thing, we call it a craft, but truthfully, I don't know how six of anybody, even little kids, could go in there and fly anywhere in this thing. It was so small. It wasn't much bigger than the pump house swimming pool. And I'm not the greatest at estimating height and stuff, but I'm going to say it was probably about 10 feet tall, mm-hmm. and in shape like an egg. Right. And there was at one point, I didn't think it was actually touching the ground because I thought I sensed, almost saw it kind of waver just slightly. And it kind of reminded me of like a bobber on a super smooth, quiet lake that'll just every now and then just kind of like that on a wave. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it had four long appendages off of the sides of it from about the middle down, but they didn't look thick or strong enough to bear weight. Mm-hmm. So in retrospect, I guess that they could have just been to stabilize it. I don't know. I mean, that's purely my guess. I have no clue. I can just describe what I saw.
Well, you mentioned the size of the house that back in Detroit when you were a kid, and mm-hmm. I walked in, and it looked huge inside.
Yeah.
And so this sounds like it's pretty much on the same principle, this egg-shaped let's call it a craft.
Yeah, that's well, for lack of anything else to call it, really.
Did you go into that craft at the time?
I have no conscious memory of that. Okay. No, maybe I did. I still don't remember. Honestly, Bud told me that his calculations between talking to my mom, talking to the people that whose house I was at, and who I talked about later, I still only remember maybe 10 minutes of what was potentially an hour and a half. Wow. So I could have been in that thing. I don't know. But when I saw it, I flipped out.
I need to take one moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making wave. You're listening to We Are Not Alone, and we're talking to Deborah Jordan Cobble, the subject of Bud Hopkins' book, Intruders. So we're talking about going into the craft. You don't know if you were in the craft. Are there any experiences aboard a craft of any kind that you recall consciously, or did they all require hypnosis?
I had some snippets of conscious recollection, spontaneous recollection, but I remembered most of them like when I first woke up from sleep. So almost like some of it came back to me in a dream state. You know what I mean? And then there's some conscious recollections. Like I don't ever recall going into a craft or coming out of one. I, you know, like some people remember walking in or being walked into or lifted up into one. I don't remember anything like that. I remember being in one. I remember being in one or in something. Let me just say, I remember being somewhere that wasn't anywhere I have ever been in this life.
What did it look like?
It was, the walls were black, like granite, shiny, smooth and cold. Mm-hmm. And they had the symbols that I drew were almost like you could feel them. They were like carved into the wall, but then they were like white. So the granite was black, or this material was black. The symbols were white and you could feel them. When I touched them, I could feel them. And I drew these symbols. I would be like driving down the street or doing some mundane task, like washing dishes or whatever. And all of a sudden, bam, it would come in my head. This memory would come back to me and I'd be like, oh my gosh. And I would have to write it down before I forgot it. And I couldn't finish what I was doing or focus on anything else until I was able to draw it or write it down. Sometimes I would also do that with words or phrases that would pop into my head and I would have to write them down. Or I couldn't function. There was a few times I had to actually pull over while I was driving because something came back and it was so intense that I would have to pull over and process it and then write it down. And once I got it out of my head and down on paper, I could let it go and I could refocus on what I was doing.
Did these phrases make any sense to you, or are they just gibberish? Or
some of them did. They made sense in a way, but I didn't necessarily understand what they meant. Like one time I wrote down, all the answers are in the blood.
Uh-oh.
And I wrote that down. And one time I wrote down something about making brain cells regenerate with electricity. I can't remember. It's in the book, you know. So this has been 40 years ago, so it's it's been a while. And sometimes it might just be a word or a phrase back then.
The answers are in the blood. Does that sound like genetics to you?
Well, yeah, it does to me now. Back then, I didn't really understand what that meant because that was something I probably like 90 or 91 had written something like that down.
Well, I've studied a lot on the UFO subject, and I'm sure you have too. And I think that you've heard or probably know that alien abduction experiences follow family lines, are in the genes, shall we say, or in the blood.
Yes, I know that. And my sister, my older sister I told you about, back in 1965 in Indianapolis, she had something happen to her. And she was taking my mom to bingo and dropped my mom off the bingo game. And on the way back home, she felt compelled to pull into the parking lot of this church on 10th Street. So she pulled back into the back of this parking lot behind the church. And she said that as soon as she got to the parking lot, she looked up and there was a giant UFO hovering right above her car. And she said that this thing lifted her entire car up with her in it. And the next thing she remembered, she was waking up in her car. And it was several hours had passed. Not only that, she had to, it was almost time to go get mom. And it was dark out. So she headed back to the bingo place and picked up my mother and frantically told mom what she could remember. And, you know, I had heard them, all of us other younger kids, there were two other kids younger than me. And we had heard the story before and we just assumed that, okay, you know, it happens because why would she have any reason to lie about it? And then when we got older, we'd tease her about it and she'd get mad and wouldn't talk about it anymore. And so we kind of thought we like that because we like picking on her. Yeah. But so there's that, my sister. And then my mother told Bud, you know, I have a scoop mark on my shin that I thought was a birthmark because I've had it ever since I could remember. And my mother has one exactly like it. And I thought it was a birthmark for her. And, but when Bud asked her if she had anything strange that she could remember in her life, and she didn't remember a whole lot because my mother was adopted when she was two out of the orphanage in Louisville by a staff sergeant in the Army. But she remembered being somewhere playing in the woods and a little boy started to chase her. And she remembers falling and something poking her in the leg and it hurt. And that's all she remembered. But for some reason or another, when Bud asked her if she had anything connected to any weird stuff like this, that popped up in her mind. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but there had to be something behind it for her that to come up, you know, and her telling, and I had never heard that. I didn't even know about that. And nobody else did until Bud asked her and she told us. We didn't even know about it. So there's my mother and my older sister and myself at least. So, and then my kids and then potentially a grandma. So there's four generations that I know of that have had strange things happen. And I don't, like I said, don't know anything about I don't know a lot about my mom's real family. So
when you say you have a mark on your leg, would you describe it as a scoop mark?
Oh yeah.
And is that on the back of your calf?
No, mine's actually on my shin.
On your shin?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's on the shin. And I had a doctor one time ask me if I'd had a punch biopsy or something, or a bone marrow test. I can't remember what it was. I'm like, no. It just has a real, it's not as easy to see now that I'm A, older, and B, 100 pounds lighter. Mm-hmm. But it had a very crisp, clean edge. And it just looked like somebody took an ice cream scoop and just scooped a, you know, hunk of meat out.
Reason I ask is mine's on the back of my right shin.
Okay.
Yeah, so I have one of those too.
Oh, but anyway, when I after that night in June of 83, and I sent the letter to Bud, you know, he called. I remembered. It was weird because the next morning after that night when I woke up, my eyes were swelled completely shut and I was in so much pain that my mom took me to the emergency room. And at that point, I didn't remember the light or the kids in the yard or that egg-shaped thing. Mm-hmm. That memory all went away shortly after it happened. As soon as I heard my name being called by my mom, it was like somebody just snapped their fingers and I woke up from some nightmare. But a couple days later, when the family came over, to celebrate 4th of July and go swimming, we noticed this mark in the yard. It was about an 8-foot diameter circle, and it had a 49-foot streak coming off one side. And all the grass in it was gray and laid down, and the soil under it was rock hard and smelled kind of weird. And first thing my mom said was, "Oh, that's where our UFO landed the other night." And when I looked at her like, "What are you, crazy? Why would you say that?" She was kind of nervously giggling, and the other kids and, you know, the other adults were kind of giggling a little bit. And then it hit me. That, and I started to remember things immediately. I remembered the light. I started remembering the kids that were in the yard, the craft. And I kind of pretty much had a nervous breakdown from that point on for the next 3 months. But I was sick all the time. My eyes were wrecked the next day. I went to the emergency room, and the doctor who ended up examining me asked me if I'd looked into the arc of a welder's torch, which I looked at him and said, "No, why would I do that?" the dog that had been out there with me that night started to develop what we thought was mange, and eventually by 6 or 8 weeks after that, she had to be put to sleep. She was just, she fell apart.
Wow.
And I started getting sick, and my glands would swell up. I'd get rashes. I'd get these random fevers that would come and go. I had real bad palpitations, and I started having panic attacks real bad. I remembered was the address to that book in Missing Time. And that's when I went, got the address out of the book at the library, and I wrote to Bud. And then Bud eventually wrote back, and that is how I got in contact with him. And that's what started the whole ball rolling.
At any time, were these symptoms diagnosed as radioactive poisoning?
No. And of course, I did not tell, even when I started, even after I remembered the light and everything, I didn't tell doctors anything, because I was wrestling with it myself, thinking I was crazy and there had to be another explanation for it. And I sure didn't want to tell. Well, you know, it was, first of all, it was a different time. You know, this was 83, and you didn't talk about these kind of things unless you were wearing a tinfoil hat, you know, or something. And I was doing everything in my power to figure out what caused this and what was happening to me. And I wondered if it had to do with this stuff, but I hoped it didn't. And one of the things I hoped to achieve when I reached out to Bud was for him to say, "No, that's not what this is."
Okay. You were hoping that.
Huh? Yeah. I mean, even when I did the psychological testing with the doctors at that hospital that he took me to in New York, mm-hmm. I told him, you know, it's okay if I'm crazy. You can, you know, I'm okay if you tell me I'm crazy, because I know they make pills for that. And I'm okay with that. But I was diagnosed with PTSD.
Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's something that abductees have in common. They're perfectly sane, but you know, after testing, but they all share that one thing, that they suffer from PTSD. Mm-hmm. From what? Well, I think you know the answer. So.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things the doctor said to Bud was, you know, you have to have had something traumatic happen to you, right, for you to have these symptoms. So,
I was always told a truly insane person never questions their own sanity.
Yeah, that's what Dr. Kilmar told me.
If you think you're going insane, you're all right.
You probably aren't, you know. Although I suppose there's always exceptions to every rule, but I was always trying to figure out what it was, and I contacted the agricultural agency, state of Indiana at Purdue, the gas company, just whoever I could think of. What would cause this mark in the yard? You know, what would cause me to have this bright flash? You know, I contacted the weather service and tried to look for the weather that night, or even if there was any storms in the vicinity, you know, where there could be like a random light. The investigator in me started kicking in right away.
All right.
And this was even before I joined MUFON. And it was just me trying to figure out a rational explanation for it, because the other option just was too traumatic for me to think about, you know.
Right.
And I was remembering things consciously, little flashes and bits of things, and then, you know, and some of it would come back, and when I was asleep, And I would have a nightmare, and then I'd realize, oh my God, this is a memory, not a dream, you know. Right. And I still called them all dreams, because that was the most comfortable way to deal with it. But you know, that wasn't all the stuff I remembered. And I was hypnotized by Bud maybe 5 times, I think, because people don't realize I lived 1,000 miles away from him when he was in New York and I was in Indy. And we didn't have the internet. We didn't have cell phones. We did our business by very expensive and very short long distance phone calls and a lot of letter writing. Mm-hmm. So the opportunities that we had were few and far between. And the first time I went to New York, I was actually hypnotized by Dr. Clamar, who's the psychiatrist that Bud was working with. Mm-hmm. And that session, I didn't remember nothing. I had no memory comes back at all, but I did feel more relaxed. And I would say most of the sessions that I had with Bud, I had a lot of stuff that I had already consciously remembered. Like the time when I was 16 and I was out driving around with a friend of mine and we saw this light in the sky that came down. And I remembered being pulled out of the car by my legs and being enveloped in some kind of black cloud thing. What I didn't remember was the light in the sky coming down and landing in the field next to us and the girlfriend that I was with pulling over and getting out of the car. And I didn't even realize that that had happened until 20 years later when Bud talked to her and he said, I want to ask you about the night that you and Debbie and that other girl saw the light in the sky when you were out driving around. She's like, oh yeah. She goes, do you mean the light in the sky or the one that was on the ground? And I turned around and looked at her. I'm like, what? She's like, yeah, we pulled over after you saw that light. I pulled over because it was getting close and it landed next to the car and I got out and I'm like, what? So, you know, that stuff like that happened. I always likened the hypnosis to, I already remembered seeing the accident and I remembered the car and I knew that I remembered a license plate, but under hypnosis, I remembered what color the car was and I could remember the numbers on the plate. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It just kind of took what I had already known and just kind of helped me to glean a few more small details out. It wasn't anything that I didn't already remember.
So how Hollywoodized would you say the TV miniseries of Intruders was?
A lot.
A lot?
Yes, a lot. And much to my chagrin. And I was very disappointed with it early on because I was the one that had to go out in public when I would go with Bud and then later on my own and talk to people. And I'd get a bunch of people that would come up to me and say, do you remember in the miniseries when this happened, and that happened to me? And I'm like, that wasn't me. I mean, I would have to tell them it wasn't me. And I felt bad about it because they were really, you know, wanting to connect with me on that. And I listened to them and tried to be supportive, but I had to tell them that wasn't me. Mm-hmm. What Tracy did was, he bought the option for Intruders, which gave him the rights to do whatever he wanted. Okay. He took a couple of scenes directly from the book. There was a couple scenes there that were from the book, but everything else except the title was Hollywood license. He took different real cases and combined them to create a completely new person.
Right.
with these. Their facts, but they weren't mine. So it was this conglomeration of stuff that I had very little to do with at the end. And I, like I said, I was.
What happened in the miniseries has happened to experiencers, alien experiencers.
Oh, yeah. That was all taken from actual case reports.
Right.
That Tracy was able to get permission to use the, as long as you know, he didn't use the names of the people and stuff. He created new people with it. But in retrospect, like I've said this before, I was disappointed at first because it was our name mm-hmm. on there, you know, and I was disappointed that wasn't true to our own personal story. But it, for the time, you know, for that period of time, It was one of the first things done on mainstream media with, you know, mainstream actors and stuff that was done respectfully without a laugh track and, you know, corny music and stuff. They did it in a respectful way and they treated it, you know, like they really wanted to convey a story. So even Mare Winningham, who played me, called me twice because she wanted to make sure she was playing my role in this particular scene the way I did feel during the actual event. So I appreciated that.
Let me take one more moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with real-life intruders subject, Deborah Jordan Cottle. And so you say that most of the miniseries was not you, but a couple incidences are taken from your events. What couple of incidences were those?
The one where they were near the end with the when the girl sees the I might have been like the last scene. I haven't seen it in 25 years. I can't remember. But I think it was what the last scene where I am presented with this little girl. I'm shown this little girl that they have. That came from the book. That is a memory that I have of being shown, being in a place with, I don't know whether I was on a craft or I was in a completely different place. I don't know how I got there and I don't know how I got home, but I was in a room. And there were several of these gray things in the room, and there was a child with them that was, I thought, looked to be maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years, 4 or 5, you know, a small child.
Right.
She looked mostly human to me. I mean, you could have put a pair of Mary Janes on her in a pinafore, and you might think she just was a kind of a sickly little skinny kid, but pretty much, you know, human. And when they first brought her into the room, and I remember thinking, why are they bringing this child in here? And then I looked at her and I immediately felt, oh my God, that's mine. And my instinct was to grab her. And as soon as that thought went into my head, it was like she could hear what I was thinking because she darted behind one of them and looked like she was terrified of me. And in that instant, I was heartbroken. I was like, I thought, oh my God, she's terrified of me. And then I thought, okay, if this is all she's used to seeing, I guess I do look pretty scary. Mm-hmm. And then maybe if she heard what I was, if she knew that I was going to try and grab her, you know, how would she know that?
Yeah.
But so that was a scene in the movie, and that was mine. That was true. And that's the one that she called me twice about because she wanted to know how, you know, she, which I appreciated. That made me feel like she actually cared and wanted to do justice by it.
Right.
You know, even though it was a compilation of a lot of different cases and it really wasn't true to our actual story, I realized it didn't take me long to realize that it did really provide a great service because it brought the subject matter and awareness to an entire new group of people that had probably never heard of anything like that before.
Right. That's right.
You know, it brought it to the forefront and it did it with some dignity and respect. And so that was a good thing.
So that was one incident, and the other was what?
I'm trying to think again. I think it had to do with another experience that I had where I had some kind of a medical exam and it was very painful and traumatic for me. Mm-hmm. And, I think that's pretty much the only couple scenes that really had, you know, anything. I'm not for sure. It's like I said, it's been so long since I've seen it. I'd have to go back and rewatch it to be able to tell you exactly which ones were from the book and what I'd never heard of. So
20 years ago, eh?
It's been a while. It's been more than 20. I'd say. Yeah. I'm trying to be kind to myself, I guess.
Do you feel or do you know that you have been implanted with some sort of tracking device? And do you feel that way?
Yeah, sometimes I did. When I was younger, I definitely think I felt like that.
Have you had x-rays or MRIs to try to confirm this?
Well, I did have I've had lots of MRIs of my brain and stuff now because I have fibromuscular dysplasia in the renal arteries, which can go everywhere. So they watch all of my arteries and veins and stuff, including my neck and head. And I have some bright spots in my brain scans, but they tell me that I shouldn't be concerned with them. So I'm not sure what they are. I had on my other shin, there was a lump on my other shin when I was a teenager, and I could roll it up and down my shin. And literally, I could roll it almost from my knee to my ankle. Mm-hmm. And where it rested on my shin was like a little dip that you could put your finger in. And my doctor was actually more I went in to have my gallbladder out when I was like 13 or 14, and they took this out at the same time. And the doctor told my parents he was actually more concerned with this lump on my leg than he was my gallbladder because of he was thinking bone cancer or something. Mm-hmm. And when it was removed, I had asked him if I could have it just because I thought it was cool. And I kept rolling it up and down my leg all the time. And he told me I could have it when I went into surgery. He also told me I could have my gallstones, and I didn't get those either. But he said, I believe that he said it was a round ball it was a round object that was calcified, and it was perfectly round, and that the dip that they could feel with their finger that they thought was my actual shin bone was a perfectly square pad of fat that my body had developed right under this thing. Mm-hmm. And it was as if my body was protecting my bone from this thing.
Right.
And so he said, because I remember him saying, you have a smart body, you know, that it did this. Well, I'm like, where is it? Because you said I could have it. He's like, oh, you can't have it. They didn't let me have that or my gallbladder. So I don't ever know what happened to it.
Yeah, I wonder.
That's a pretty weird thing.
I wonder if they sent it out to, you know, exactly what is this thing? You know? What procedures were employed by Bud Hopkins to validate your accounts?
Okay, let's see. He came out to the house several times and he interviewed the neighbors. He interviewed people from my past. He interviewed my friends. I think he interviewed one time he interviewed one of my bosses at one of my jobs. Of course, all the family. He took samples of the soil, which he sent off for testing. I incidentally still have some soil samples. They're 40 years old, but I still got them. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to New York, I sold my washer and dryer that was in storage to buy a bus ticket to go to New York. And the first time I went is when I was introduced to Dr. Clamart. He took me right from the bus station to her office, the psychiatrist, mm-hmm. you know. And so I talked with her, and she hypnotized me. And then I don't think it was that first time I went to New York, but it was maybe the next time I went. I was taken to I believe it was Columbia Hospital. I'm not for sure. I can't remember the exact place. It was a big hospital in New York City. Yeah. Bud had either gotten donations to pay for this or donated time for it. I don't know how he came about, but I was given an EEG of my brain where they put the wires on your head mm-hmm. for like to see if you have epilepsy or something.
All right.
And I was given a CAT scan that I had to sign a waiver for. I had 6 hours of psychological testing, both verbal and written, at this hospital with these people. And I had something called a voice stress test, which was, I told, like a lie detector test, but it registered my voice.
Right.
Or something. Bud made arrangements for this man. Now that actually happened, I think, here in Indiana. And Bud had made arrangements for this guy to do it. I think he was like a retired police officer or something. And he did it blind. He didn't know he didn't know anything. And so after the test was over with, I remember him, Bud told me that the guy said, "Well, I don't know if UFOs and all that are real." And it kind of, I think, shook him up a little bit. He says, "But I can tell you that she believes that it is."
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he couldn't say, yeah, she was abducted by aliens, but he could say, yeah, she believes she was abducted by aliens.
Well, that's what a lie detector test is.
Yeah.
No.
So he did a lot of stuff over a period of time. And that's why after a few years of this, he came to my whole family and said, "Look, we've got independent witnesses. We have this mark in the yard," which, by the way, that mark lasted for a couple years. And the first year that it was there, snow melted off of it. After snow would start falling down, right, you go outside and look, you know, we could get a half an inch of snow, and there wouldn't be any snow on this mark at all. It was like a snow circle instead of a crop circle. Mm-hmm. But so we had that. We had two different independent witnesses, and eventually we had a third one, like 20 years later, that came forward. Plus my mom. That's besides my mom and the two people that, you know, the man and woman whose house I was at, and their daughter. Mm-hmm. All kinds of, you know, stuff. The cable, my dad had a 100-foot ham tower out there, and the coax cable from the tower to the house, inside the cable sheathing or whatever was melded together.
Mm.
Not the plastic, the cable inside, the wires inside.
Wow.
Just all kinds of stuff like that. And then, you know, the soil samples and everything, and then what I did remember consciously. He says, I think, and then the other things that happened, you know, when I was younger, and with my other family members, and even some friends that I had strange experiences with, you know, he's like, I think this is an important story. And I think that the world should know about it. And I want to write a book about this. Mm-hmm. And our first reaction was, I don't think so. Thank you, but no thank you. I mean, I initially contacted him because I wanted him to tell me what this was and help me figure it out. But the more we investigated it, the more crazy it got.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but eventually, you know, it was a whole family decision, and we finally decided, Bud convinced us that we would help enough people that we went ahead, as long as we could protect our family, which that's where the pseudonyms came in.
Right. So are you and or your family members still undergoing abductions?
As far as my family members go, I don't know, because we don't talk very much about it. My older sister is, unfortunately, has vascular dementia, and she's in a nursing home, and she doesn't even know who I am. So,
sorry to hear that.
You know, and then my other two siblings, they haven't said anything to me about anything like that. The last time I remember a family member having any strange things was my granddaughter when she was about 5 or 6, had a period of time where she was having night terrors, and she told her dad that the aliens were trying to take her. And he got mad at me because he thought I had been saying something around her, which was absolutely not the case. Mm-hmm. Had no idea. And I was heartbroken to hear this, that she was going through that. And he was mad as hell at me because he swore up and down that she had to have heard something from me or my husband, which didn't, that wasn't the case.
How old?
Now, she was 5 or 6 at the time. Same age as me when I first disappeared. But the funny thing is, like, years and years later, she was probably 14 or 15 years old, and she was here at the house with me, and we were watching TV, and a commercial for Ancient Aliens came on. And my first instinct was to change the channel because we just didn't let her expose her to any of that.
Right.
And then I thought, oh, hell, she's probably heard all, she probably knows more than me now. She's in high school, you know. And when the commercial was over, she turned around, looked at me, and she said, "Hey, Nene, do you believe in aliens?" And I just looked at her for a minute, and I said, "Yeah." And that, I didn't say anything else. And she said, good, so do I. And I'm like, okay. And then I thought in my head, now she knows if she ever wants to talk about anything, she can talk to me. I'm never going to broach it with her. Mm-hmm. I will let her come to me. Wow. But so, you know, that could be something, but hopefully not. I hate to think of it, that she went through the terrible terrors that she had when she was kids, and it was because, yeah, little, and it was because of them.
At the same time, you went through it, and you know that you survived, and
true,
these do survive, and
oh yeah. And not only that, I mean, it was because of the experiences in 83 that I met Bud, and it was because of Bud that other things in my life were profoundly and irreversibly changed. And so I can confidently say that even though early on it scared the hell out of me, it was terrifying, I wouldn't change anything now, because my life would not even be recognizable if it weren't for this phenomenon. And I feel as if something inside of me has opened up and I've grown in many ways that I would not have been able to have grown had I not had these experiences. It's very hard to describe. And it's an almost spiritual, but yet I'm not religious and I'm not, you know, I'm not like that at all. But it just seems a consciousness of raising an awareness of my surroundings and of myself and of my connection to other people and life. And I mean, just, you know, my brain kind of exploded after a while and I grew from all of it. So
do you feel do you feel a certain kinship with your abductor?
Not in the way that you would be like, what do they call that? The Stockholm syndrome. I mean, not in that way. A kinship in the knowledge that we're all alive and that they contain the same life that I contain, a life in that manner.
Life form, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In that way, yes. And although I do have to say, it seemed like each time, well, like the experience I had when I was a teenager, the experience I had when I was a young, newly married lady, June 30, 83, and then in another experience when I was a little bit older than that, it seemed like there was always one, even if there were multiple of these gray things in the area, it seemed as if I had a recognition of one of them.
Okay.
Like they felt different,
mm-hmm.
You know, like I recognized them.
And where can our listeners go to find out more about your books and your work? You have a website?
Yes, it's called debshome.com, spelled just like it sounds. And there you can learn more about me, see some of my drawings, see some of the things I wrote down. It's kind of almost been a little bit of a diary vlog, as well as some news of the day sort of things that might be of interest to people like me and other things like that. And I have that there. You can write to me through there. You can buy the book through there. You can buy the book on Amazon or the Books a Million, Barnes and Noble's online, any of the online big retail sellers, you can pick it up there. It's called Extraordinary Contact, Life Beyond Intruders. As far as the first book, Abducted, goes, good luck trying to find it. You might find it in a library or a flea market or something, but it's been out of print for 20 years. So,
Deborah, it has been great having you on our show. And sounds like there's more to tell that we haven't been able to cover. So maybe we can get together again sometime.
Okay, that'd be great. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archive shows. Or click on the Talk Shows button, then the We Are Not Alone button for the latest show archives. And please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.